Welcome back to the Vanguardistas for take three and the regular feature that sports what I think is the greatest jingle in the show currently. It's Questions Schmestions.
Questions Schmestions.
Fantastic. Okay, number one from Howard Sweet, short and to the point. Dear both, LTL, no jokes, no puns. How was Danielle Deadwyler not nominated for an Oscar? I don't understand. Just watch Till, amazing and gut-wrenching. Everyone should watch it. Now, before we address this,
yes,
it's connected to our next email, which is longer from Steph in East London. Hi, Simon and Mark. LTL, FTE, if this gets read out. I wanted to get Mark's view on Andrea Riseborough's somewhat surprising nomination for the Oscar for Best Actress for her performance in the indie film To Leslie. I'm a bit on the fence. On the one hand, her performance has been widely praised. I haven't seen the film, though, so can't comment personally. And I'm generally in favour of small independent films getting more attention from the big awards ceremonies. However, I feel like there's been a ridiculous amount of lobbying from predominantly, if not all, big white Hollywood names. Gwyneth Paltrow, Jane Fonda, Jennifer Aniston, Edward Norton, to name a few. And what particularly annoys me is that her nomination seems to have pushed out Danielle Deadwyler and Viola Davis, who Mark and crucially Variety, although I'd say crucially Mark, suggested deserved nominations for their roles in Till and The Woman King, respectively. At best, the optics are bad. At worst, it shows the Hollywood elite perpetuating an unabashed misogyny towards black women, the words of Chinua Achebe, the director of Till. Mm-hmm. What does Mark think? Is this a win for a small indie film or further evidence that we need to disregard these arbitrary awards ceremonies completely? Ding dong and down with wet Smurfahunter's Borathons. Steph.
Okay, well, let's do this properly, okay? Because you've seen both. Okay, so we can have a proper discussion about this. So let's begin by just saying all awards ceremonies are essentially stupid and nonsense. And if you take any guidance from them, more fool you. Okay, there is no way that the Oscars represent the best of cinema. If that was the case, I would have given up on cinema ages ago. All you need to know about the Oscars is that Citizen Kane didn't win the Oscar for Best Picture, but Driving Miss Daisy did. That's it, okay, in a nutshell. That said, everyone who's ever won an award, who I have ever spoken to about it, has said, look, you can say what you like, it affected my career, changed my career. I was just doing the commentary for Ennis Main with Mark Jenkin for the Blu-ray of Ennis Main. And we were talking about the impact that the BAFTA win had had on Bait and the fact that Bait ended up being, you know, a fairly significant independent hit. And Ennis Main has done really well in an environment which is not friendly to independent movies. So you can't discount them, but you can accept that they are ridiculous. Now, in terms of the Andrea Riseborough thing, there are two things at issue. One of them is that the Variety predictions had Viola Davis and Danielle Deadwyler as kind of, they sort of thought they had a lock on the first four, and they thought there was one position that was tenuous.
Okay? Which in the end went to Michelle Williams.
Yeah.
For The Fablemans.
Yeah.
However much I love that film, I agree that to me feels like the fifth.
Yeah, fine. So there was this idea that somehow there was a block of nominations and a space for either Viola Davis or Danielle Deadwyler. This isn't true. This never was true. This never was the case. And the problem with Variety predictions is, and I mean, heaven knows anyone in this profession reads them, partly because they're self-fulfilling prophecies, because if Variety starts saying something, it starts being true. But at the time, Andrea Riseborough wasn't on anybody's radar. I mean, she wasn't on those lists. That's where it was. She wasn't in contention. Then what happened is that in the 2 weeks, and it was literally really the 2 weeks leading up to the nomination, suddenly out of the woodwork come all these people saying, this is an amazing performance. You really need to see this before you vote. The first I knew about To Leslie was, what's all this stuff going on the internet, which is the joke about Barack Obama has redone his best of the year list to be able to put To Leslie in it. Alfred Hitchcock has talked to somebody through a Ouija board to say it's the best performance he's ever seen, because immediately when you had all these celebrities saying it's the best thing I've ever seen, suddenly there was the backlash. It was a bit of a joke. I interviewed Andrea Riseborough on the Monday night before the Oscar nominations came out.
That was the night before, right? Mm-hmm. They were on the Tuesday.
The night before. They were on the Tuesday. And the last thing that Variety had said was, I mean, there was a bit of a, you know, thing about, oh, you know, is this all right? You know, is this upsetting the apple cart because the Variety list hadn't had her in the running. And Variety was saying at that point, look, it's not going to happen because it's just too little too late. You know, you can't game an Oscar campaign that fast because Oscar campaigns go back to, I mean, Venice, really.
Yeah. Brendan Fraser's standing ovation at Venice was fine. The moment at which that became a best actor.
So the awards corridor now, because it was Toronto, is it Toronto? What's the official starting point for awards corridor now? Is it Venice?
I mean, really, it's Venice.
Right, yes. Okay, fine.
So let's say a good 6 months.
Fine. From then onwards, you are literally into the thing. And both Viola Davis and Danielle Deadweiler were working that campaign. It's hard work. Incidentally, if you're out there working an awards campaign, it's really tiring. I don't say it's somebody who's done it. I say it's somebody who's seen people do it. And so when I interviewed Andrea Riseborough on the Monday night, I said to her, look, how do you feel about all this? And she said, I don't know. Look, I'm just, it's nice that people are watching the film because I'm really proud of it. And they're talking about maybe giving it a push and maybe being re-released because people like me were now seeking it out and watching it and going, well, actually, she's really good. I mean, I think it's a solid film with a very good performance. I also think it's impossible, incidentally, to judge between one performance and another performance most of the time. I think it's like comparing apples and buses. It's like there is literally no comparison. And then the next morning, when it was announced that Riseborough had got a nomination, it was like, wow, look at that. And then it was immediately followed by, how dare she? Because what she did was knocked off either Viola Davis or Danielle Deadweiler, which isn't true. The Academy then said that they would do an investigation. We're recording this on the Wednesday. And is the investigation, did it happen yesterday?
It's been completed.
And
the outcome is that it's not going to revoke her nomination.
There's a shock.
But
they are going to put guardrails in.
So they're going to look at addressing the tactics that had secured it. Now, it's not really clear what's wrong with those tactics to me. I mean, it is what I think disturbed and upset Variety and the whole kind of awards industrial complex about this so much.
They didn't see it coming.
Is that first, they didn't see it coming because they weren't involved. And the whole thing about awards season is that an enormous amount of money is ploughed into those publications with these lavish print ad campaigns. And,
for your consideration.
Exactly, the full page sort of, please consider a person.
Eligible in all categories.
Absolutely. And then you also have the kind of round table discussions where all the great and the good come together and talk very with great kind of sincerity and ferocity about, what all they've piled into these roles. Andrea Riseborough was never involved, to the best of my knowledge, in any of that theatre whatsoever. And it's about kind of establishing that even in these, kind of fragmented times, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, Deadline, these absolute bastions of the trade press in Hollywood, still call the shots in awards season. And the studios better be piling campaign money into these publications for ad space and what have you. And
because otherwise, what are they for?
Exactly. And what the Andrea Riseborough thing shows is you don't need them. As long as you've got, admittedly, it's not that, it's slightly crass because it's all these celebrities suddenly going, oh, wow, what a great performance. So it relied very much on big name recognition, like Edward Norton posting on Instagram. But, he's not wrong. The performance is amazing. It's like Cassavetes style. And that's, I think, partly what appeals so much about it to actors is they see this
Jane
other
Fonda.
Potential.
Jane
yeah,
Fonda.
Right, exactly. It's they see this other route, this style of acting that is very out of fashion at the moment in terms of studio productions. There's still space for it. And, let's kind of champion this. I think so. That to me is where the industry's discomfort lies. And I think the idea that she has knocked out black actresses from the race is,
it's
obviously
specious.
It's outrageous that those two are not in the race.
Because
Danielle Deadweiler, that is an excellent performance.
Yeah.
But it's very useful to be able to confect this kind of racial component to it.
Yeah.
When actually what people are upset about really is that she got into the party without being on the list.
I agree. And so I think that, to kind of, the fact that the list is what it is and the fact that Viola Davis and Danielle Deadweiler are not on it is not the fault of Andrea Riseborough or the campaign or whatever it is. The other, it's an indication of what's wrong with the industry and what's wrong with awards. There is no question about it. The other thing I'd like to say is the idea that somehow there is, there's this proper campaigning that goes on and what these people have done about. Have you seen an Oscar campaign? Do you not remember how Harvey Weinstein personally you know, got all his movies to get Oscar nominations by barreling through the most aggressive, underhand, you know, let's just attack everybody else. If you like that movie that's not ours, you're a Nazi. If you like that movie, that's a, you can. Oscar campaigning is like pigs in mud.
Yes.
Well, wrestling each other. It is an absolute, it's a foul endeavor. It involves money and time. And when I was used to do the Kermode Awards, the whole joke of it was the reason none of these performances are in contention is they don't have studios behind them spending the kind of money that's necessary to even get them up onto the platform. So don't come round all sanctimonious. Oh, we're going to look at it now, and oh, we're going to review our practices. Get a life. Your practices are basically bear baiting. That's what Oscar campaigning is like. It is the modern equivalent of illegal dogfighting, and claiming that somehow somebody in that fight was dirty is, well, laughable.
So, Steph, there's your answer. Now, onto an email from John Bentley Smith in Cambridge. LTL, second time emailer. Love the show for your warmth, good humour, engaging interviews, tip-top reviews, and most of all for the comfort of having two friends whittering in my ears through difficult times. Question. Please, could you recommend some books on the art of film criticism? And Schmestion, speaking of books, can we expect new written offerings from your good selves in the not-too-distant future? Up with the blue-haired feminists, down with Nazis, new and old.
Well, on film criticism, I mean, there's books on film. You know, Helen O'Hara's book on women in the film industry was absolutely cracking read. I thought a real page turner. But you're asking specifically about books on film criticism.
Yes, on the art of film criticism. So I suppose how to write it, how to go about doing it.
Okay, there's no getting around this. I wrote a book about film criticism. Not really on how to write, but about what I thought was happening to film criticism. It was called Hatchet Job. I think it's my least best-selling book of anything I've ever written.
As a film critic, I bought it, so there you go.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. And I think you're in it. I think I quoted a couple of conversations with you.
Yes,
or, you
I
know.
Believe so, yeah.
But it was written at a time when I was kind of fairly... I started writing at a time when I was fairly despairing about criticism. By the time I'd finished writing it, it was like, grow up, Kermode, everything's fine. The internet isn't going to destroy the world. Get a life. I struggle to think of other books about... Help me here, Robbie. Are there books about film criticism?
I don't know. I mean, look, there must be advice somewhere. My tip would be to read film criticism that you love, that has a recognisable voice, mm-hmm. and just kind of get a feel for how it works. I think if you want to understand how to write a film review, a really good way to do it is to find one that you love, and, you know, a review, a piece of critical writing that you admire. And just kind of play with it and see, you know, take a sentence that you love, the way it makes a point or the way it kind of lands a joke or something, and fiddle with individual words in it and, you know, see if you change this, how does that affect the overall feel of it? Try and apply it to a different film, you know, change this adjective, change the rhythm here and the cadence there. And then just by doing that, you start to see how the mechanisms of written criticism work. I think that's a more useful way to approach it than you know, sitting down and like kind of doing English lessons about how to piece together a review. I mean, really, there's no right way to piece together a review. And the reviews I enjoy the least are the ones that feel like they've been written to a formula. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we start with a plot summary, then we talk about this, then we talk about that, and then is it any good or not at the end? It always feels, you know, although certainly speaking personally, these reviews never flow especially easily. The ones that read the best are always the ones that feel like you're just kind of listening to someone talk off the top of their head.
Writing film reviews is like pulling teeth.
It is. It shouldn't read like pulling teeth.
No, precisely. Yeah. But it's like the thing about, you know, it takes a lot of effort to seem this slapdash and casual. And can I ask, how did you first start writing reviews?
Because the other critic was sick. It was as simple as that. I was in the office and someone was off ill. It's career-wise, this is a different conversation.
That is a whole different thing.
It's about manoeuvring yourself into a position where you can write a review if you're so required to do so. But yes, in terms of writing criticism for the love of it, it's about looking at criticism that you love, I think. I mean, nobody's perfect. The compilation of Anthony Lane's early stuff in The New Yorker, to me, that's the Bible. You know, you kind of, that writing is, I mean, clearly immensely kind of cleverly constructed, but when you read it, it just feels like it's pouring off the page into your face, and it's so, so beautiful.
Okay, so, sorry, before you, I know you're eager to get onto another, but so name me a couple of your favourite writers. Actually, I'll start.
Okay,
so... I think Wendy Eide writes like, I wish I could do that. Because Wendy is my colleague on The Observer, and every single week I read that and go, Why am I even trying? Because she's funny and sharp and she knows the stuff and she's got a festival nose.
The nose is an enormous part of it. Like, it's not even just in the turns of phrase, but it's about having that kind of sensibility that, you know, the feel for what's going to be worth watching here. What should I be directing people towards? Yeah. If I'm at a festival with Wendy, I will, you know, shamelessly
follow
quiz
that.
Her on what I should be watching. You know, what have you, you know, what do you think looks good here? Because she will always be right.
Yeah.
One of the things that I love about film criticism, and that I always have to, as someone who's writing this stuff week in, week out as well, try to steer clear of, are the kind of reviews that when you read them, it puts a frame around the film itself. So it's you know, it contextualizes, this is the way in which you will understand this film, in which you will think about this film forevermore. And if you read that before writing your own, it's ruinous, because then you're stuck, right? Or you try and construct your own frame very, very deliberately. No, my frame's different. And it's
quite... Well, I should say, an interesting, because this happened off record when we were talking about EO, and I said, like Night of the Hunter, and then the expression on your face, which was partly agreement and partly, oh, hell. And then you said, I said, why? And you said, because I've mentioned Night of the Hunter in my review, and I'm now thinking, do I need to go and take it out? Because it's... And of course, we all live with the fact that people read our reviews. Like, I write reviews for The Observer. They come out on Sunday. You and I are recording this Wednesday. This will come out Friday. You've probably already filed the Telegraph review, which will come out. It's the idea that we're all being influenced by each other's review. We're not. It's like a really weird... And you all live in fear of making the gag that somebody else made. The other people are saying, because I need to come with your suggestions, I would say Trevor Johnston for sheer writing. How did that sentence get constructed? You know, like Hunter Thompson used to sit down and type out The Great Gatsby because he thought it was like practicing a piece of music. And I will literally sit there and read Trevor's reviews and go, I don't know how you made this sentence work. My great friend Nigel Floyd, who was, you know, my kind of mentor at the beginning of my career, would write a 350-word review in Time Out that said more than a 2-page spread in Sight and Sound or whatever. It was just absolutely on the money. Give me a couple of suggestions.
All right. Well, Mark Cousins' is The Story of Film, I think, is a great book in terms of having a really particular perspective on film history that is kind of deeply personal, but also incredibly well-informed. There's also a recent collection edited by a critic called Christina Newland called She Found It at the Movies, which is women writing about film, featuring an essay by Anna Bogatskaya of this parish, which is of recent collections. That's one that I've enormously enjoyed. And it's you know, relentlessly enlightening read and a very fun read as well. And criticism should be fun. You know, it should be kind of... It shouldn't be heavy-footed. It shouldn't feel like it's trying too hard.
I would also say that I think you are a writer that I read, and, you know, I told you that thing when I quoted, you know, being waterboarded with purple cement, and I go, I wish I'd written that. I really wish I'd written that line, and I think you're a brilliant writer, and I'm not just saying that.
Well, that's very kind.
But that there is... It is possible to admire somebody without... I think good film criticism is not in competition with itself. I think the best film criticism is being able to look at other film critics and go, I wish I'd done that. I wish I'd said that thing. And then, like you say, okay, well, how did they get there? How did the writer get to that point that they said that thing?
And often it will not be with the longest words in the dictionary. No. It will be with just precision of thought. And anyway, look, I could go on about this.
Sorry. But, you know, when am I going to get the chance to do this again? This is like the very rare case in which this is two film critics doing this program. So we can't do it now. When?
Well, look, I hope everyone listening has been as gripped as we were.
No one's listening. They've all stopped.
Let's move on. This is from Dr. J. Dear good doctors, Dr. J here from the wonderful United States, where I work as a physician and surgeon. I'm a relatively new listener, already subscribed. I'm part of the Vanguard, a Vanguardista. You two have quickly become my second and third favourite Brits. Jason Isaacs, of course, being number one. I have a question, or is it a shmestion? What films do you feel have changed and grown with you most over time? For example, when I first saw Pan's Labyrinth, I was young and filled with optimism. Everything goes back to Del Toro this week. I saw the movie as this wonderful fairy tale, and to me, Ophelia lived happily ever after. As the credits rolled, I knew I had just seen something special. I didn't cry. This view grew and morphed over the years. I distinctly remember watching the film again during medical school, and this time I saw it as a parable of the horrors of war and a demonstration of the depravity of man. Ophelia died, and I wept. I recently saw the film again after watching Pinocchio. I am now 31 years old. Now, this email is written from the perspective of, like, kind of crap's last tape. Reflecting on whole life. Here he is, he's 31. I've completed medical school and residency training. I'm now a father of two young girls whom I love very much. The fantasy and war stories both touched me deeply. As the movie ended, I wept. But this time, I felt Ophelia lived.
Yes.
So what's the film for you, Mark, that has come, has kind of changed shape in your mind over the years?
Well, I've got a very clear answer. I always felt Ophelia lived, incidentally. AI is the thing for me.
Oh, I'm so annoyed you brought that up because that was mine.
Well, how fascinating that we both, because I don't know what your response, but I've rehearsed this story so many times, but of course it relates to Pinocchio because Del Toro thinks that AI is the great Pinocchio telling, you know, prior to his film. When I saw AI the first time round, I was very much in the Stanley Kubrick is an artist, Steven Spielberg is a hack, how dare he do this, you know, and I wasn't, and I thought it didn't make any sense. And then what happened was my, the good lady Professor Her Indoors, who's written a lot about Spielberg, said, you know, you need to see AI again. And I said, no, I don't like it. And she said, yeah, but a lot of people who I respect do, which is a very loaded comment. And I went, right. So then we watched it again and I was in floods of tears. Now, I didn't have kids when I saw it the first time. Because when did it come out?
2001, wasn't it?
Oh, no, I did have kids.
Just immediately before?
No, I did have kids. I did have kids at that point. So it's not the children that did it because my children were born.
It was October 2001 because it was just September 11th, I think.
Of course, you're absolutely right because there was the thing outside Leicester Square with the thing about the towers. Fine, you're right. Okay. I saw it in New York because I was doing a documentary and I had to see it there. And I just remember being very underwhelmed and thinking it was very long and thinking it didn't, you know, it was very sentimental and thinking all the Flesh Fair stuff was all over the place. And then the next time I watched it, it was like being run over by a train. And I couldn't believe that I was watching the same film and I couldn't believe how wrong I'd been. And then, of course, as very well rehearsed, I have apologized to Spielberg for it. I mean, not that he would have cared what I thought back then anyway, but and not that he would care now what I think, but he said, and this is the thing that that really delighted me, because this is how in my life everything is about me. He said, you're only the second critic to ever apologize to me for a review. And the first one was, and he cited a very, very important critic who had slagged off Close Encounters and then apologized. And what I heard was he just compared me to a very, very important critic because that's the way I do it. So tell me your AI.
Yeah, well, strangely, it was AI. The other one was Eyes Wide Shut. And this is, I suppose these films both released pretty
it's
close
around
together,
about the same,
right?
Yeah. So this because was because Eyes Wide Shut is 98, 99, isn't it?
I think it was 99 because I think I remember seeing it at university, and it was that age where you're kind of getting into cinema, but you're too stupid to fully understand it. And I think that was what happened both with Eyes Wide Shut and AI. Eyes Wide Shut, I remember seeing it and thinking that was wonderful, but I don't get it yet. And it sat kind of whirring away in my head for maybe a decade. And then this, like, you know, one of these tomato-shaped egg timers, and it got round to the thing at the end of it. It's like, right, now I understand it's a masterpiece. Went back and rewatched it. Yes, it was. Okay. Completely flattened by it. AI, very spookily similar to your experience. I thought at first it was really kind of cold and mannered. But then it came at that strange point in Spielberg's career where he was very kind of transitioning from one kind of Spielberg to the other. He'd just made Saving Private Ryan, which was kind of casting forward to the more kind of quote-unquote serious films that he was going to undertake in the noughties and obviously up to the present. And it didn't sit right with me. And then it was, coincidentally or otherwise, after becoming a dad that I sat down and watched it again. And like you, was just bulldozed by the thing. I mean, absolutely squashed flat, like the train on fire in War of the Worlds, just straight over the top. And yes, I think it may be his best film, and which is saying something. Close Encounters, obviously, E.T., obviously. But I think it is right up there. It's an extraordinary piece of work. And weirdly, everything I thought worked about it least then is everything I love most.
The Flesh Fair sequence, which I was going, they just take that out. None of that makes sense. Now you watch the Flesh Fair sequence. But I think the whole of the beginning with Francis O'Connor.
Yes, yes. Yes. Lots of that. And the mad kind of casting forward. And the ending, which I totally misread the first time around.
Just sublime.
Yeah.
And Sir Ben Kingsley not being annoying. It's just, you know, I was thinking, who is that voiceover? It's wonderful. And then, that's Ben Kingsley?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep, yep.
I have seen Eyes Wide Shut again, and I still think it's
okay,
rubbish.
Fine. Right, on to the Schmestions. Anthony in Berlin writes, it's February.
I think you can leave that in. I think it's fine.
Anthony in Berlin writes, it's February. Is February the Tuesday of the calendar year? Festive season has faded. March, like Wednesday and springtime and changing clocks, still feel out of reach. Now, I've got a dog in this fight because it's my birthday in February, so I think February's great. But Mark, what do you reckon? Is February the Tuesday of months?
Well, I've always thought that the worst day of the week is, and this is funny because we're recording it on a Wednesday, but in my head when I was a school kid, Wednesday was always the low point because I think Wednesday, there was just something about, it was neither one nor t'other. Monday and Tuesday, you could still have the conversation about, did you see that thing on the television? Wednesday was far enough away from the previous weekend that you couldn't have that conversation, and far enough away, Thursday, you're there, you know, you're nearly there, and then it's, you know, then it's Friday on my mind and all that stuff. But so I don't feel negatively about February. I don't feel bad about it. It's interesting that just before we turned on, your phone went ping and you went, my phone just told me that my tax bill is gone. Once you pass January the 31st, I mean, you're in clover, right? It's like,
if you've survived that, you can survive anything.
Yeah. Oh, I think if anything, what's the worst month of the year? What's the bad month? Is it February? February.
I think it's probably January, I think. I think January is a April rough, is the a cruelest month. Ride. April is the cruelest month.
That's just Chaucer.
April is the coolest month.
No, but it's April. Is
no.
I'm sorry. There was a moment there.
Let's have a little assurance suit. Okay. The drugs of
March. Yeah. Okay, fine. Sorry. Hit myself on the head with the thing. Yeah.
Okay. Hayley in Bexhill asks. Let me do that again. Hayley in Bexhill asks, what's a belief that you hold with which many people disagree? I mean, isn't the objectively true answer all of them? Because every belief you hold, many people will disagree with it.
I'm going to let you go first.
Okay. Well, look, my kind of political compass is sort of having been raised in the 80s and 90s. You know, Blairism was the apogee for me. And this is how spookily the TikTok algorithm understands me. After, I'm not a kind of a big TikTok person, but after using TikTok for a few months, the algorithm has me so kind of pinned down that it only now shows me family cooking videos and Blair's best burns in the Commons. I mean, I am the most revolting centrist on all issues that you can imagine, which at the moment is massively unfashionable.
Welcome to the club. Welcome to the centrists of the world unite.
Honestly, every belief that I hold is one that people find loathsome and despicable.
I think the belief that I hold, although actually I did discover when I was in Strasbourg that two other people share this and we immediately formed a club and a support group, is that Sorcerer is better than Wages of Fear. The Richard Gere Breathless is better than a Buddha Soof. And the Steven Soderbergh Solaris is better than the Tarkovsky. So,
yes, I rewatched the Soderbergh Solaris. It's absolutely fantastic.
Genius.
It's so great. I think it probably is better than Tarkovsky. I'm with you on that.
Yeah. Oh, well, there we go. So there's a club of four now. Well, how do you stand on the other two?
Sorcerer. Yes, I think Sorcerer is right. But the Goddard, I'm afraid, no. I'm still team Goddard on that one.
Right. Well, then you can't join.
Mabel in Dunfermline asks, who are your favourite stand-ups?
Ooh. I haven't been to a stand-up gig for a really long time. I have an immense propensity to just Google Eddie Izzard best routines and watch Eddie Izzard does the history of World War II. Eddie Izzard does the routine about going to France and having to take a cat, a monkey, and a desk because otherwise you've got nothing to talk about because those, you know, all that.
The bilingual stuff is, from early Izzard
absolutely astonishing.
I have to say, I'm the same as you. I've fallen out of touch with the medium massively. The only stand-up comedians I've seen in the last few months were Harry Hill and Chris Rock.
So there's
a couple of, you know, up-and-comers for you to look out for in future. I mean, they're both completely hysterical. I laughed almost until I was sick at both. The one I was really upset to miss was Liz Kingsman's one-woman show, which was on in the West End after it had a run at the Fringe, I think.
Yeah.
Everyone I know who is into comedy thought that was fantastic. But look, here's my recommendation, and you're going to roll your eyes at this.
Go on.
Adam Sandler. Okay. His Netflix special, 100% Fresh, is hilarious.
Is it? Okay.
It is fantastic.
I don't roll my eyes at it because, you know, heaven knows Adam Sandler has surprised me enough times for me to understand that there is genius in there. And that's, and as I've always said, it's the thing that makes the bad stuff hurt, is that you see him doing Uncut Gems and you go... And when he, because when he won the award for the Independent Spirit Award for Best Performance for Uncut Gems,
yes.
He gave...
What, yes. Now, talking of good awards acceptance speeches,
that was
an all-timer.
Absolute genius. And he started, I'm sorry if people know this already, he began, he did it in that voice, and I'm not going to do that voice. He began by saying, I'd like to shout out to the four other nominees who will forever be known as the people who lost to Adam Sandler, which was just, it was fantastic. And then the Safdies did a speech in which they both did their speeches at the same time. Do you remember that? They did the acceptance speech. They both talked at the same time.
Oh, and I didn't see that. During the Uncut Gems cycle.
Genius. Absolute genius.
If you'd like that speech, you will love 100% Fresh. And of course, it's called 100% Fresh because he's riffing on his critical toxicity. But yeah, on his day, Sandler is, I mean, he's an actor like no other working today. And, you know, he's doing something else with Noah Baumbach. Apparently, they've set something else up. When I interviewed Todd Field recently, I had said to him, you know, with a lump in my throat, that I thought parts of Tar were quite Sandler-esque. You know, the fact that she has a punch up on stage with someone in a tuxedo is very Sandler. The fact that she's threatening a kid in the playground, that's... And, you know, I mean, actually, all great filmmakers understand how great Sandler is or can be. And he had said that he was talking to Sandler at the moment to work out something they could do together. Can you imagine a Todd Field film with Adam Sandler? Yes, please. I would love that. Now we have an email.
Because Todd Field is your connection to Eyes Wide Shut. So that's the other thing. Because
Yes, that's right.
Because he is the person who tells Tom Cruise to turn up at the place and say the word Fidelio to a man dressed as a chicken.
Now we have an email from Luke Allen Hockton, who writes to Dear Bernard and Bernard. That's a deep cut reference.
Very good.
I'm a huge fan of Richard Curtis movies. And back in 2020, when I was 16, I hosted a podcast wherein my co-host and I gave a detailed analysis of About Time. Each 30 to 60 minute episode, we would analyse and discuss 2 minutes of the film until we covered the whole thing.
Wow.
Now, look, crunching the numbers, About Time is what, a couple of hours long?
Yeah.
So that's going to be a minimum of, what, 30 hours listening?
That's amazing.
In depth.
Because it is true that when Richard Curtis is directing, brevity has rarely been his strong point.
Yes, and then with this kind of granular analysis, this is how he gets the Bernard and Bernard gag. You know the importance of Bernard, yes, okay. As a result of that incredible film, I discovered the music of Ron Sexsmith and invited him onto the show. Shortly afterwards, I was chatting with him in Twitter DMs and randomly sent him a video of my school choir doing a lockdown cover of I'm Still Standing. Ron then sent the song to Sir Elton John. Sir Elton sent a message to the school to say how much he'd loved it. And now, 3 years later, we've all been personally invited by Sir Elton to go and see him live later this year. We're all, understandably, very excited.
Wow.
This whole experience...
And this is Elton John's farewell tour, right? This is,
yes, this is
it's now or never.
Terms, yeah. This whole experience has been very surreal, you don't say, as the story has been picked up by the national and international press, and it's been so lovely to see all of my friends get the appreciation they deserve for their talents. So my question for you is, have you had any life-changing or significant moments, if you follow back the ripples, that a film was entirely responsible for? Tinkety-tonk, and down with people who dismiss feel-good films.
I mean, almost certainly, you know, too many to... So I'm leaping in. Do you want to go first or shall I?
I tried to think about this. I couldn't think of anything, which is quite sad. But I couldn't... Tracing back a major life event to one film?
Well, I mean...
I struggled with that.
I'm sorry to sound like a stuck record. I think I can trace back an enormous amount of my life to The Exorcist. I'm not just saying this. When I first started saying The Exorcist was the greatest film ever made, which was, you know, as long far back as I can remember, everyone thought it was a joke. And then everyone kept, no, you mean the greatest horror film ever made? And I went, no, I think it's the greatest film ever made. And just last night here at something else, the production company, I did a sort of talk on The Exorcist as work of art, okay? I have so many of my life events are connected to that film in ways that I can't even begin to unravel. I mean, one of them, you know, was probably, you know, the good lady Professor Her Indoors, and I, our relationship began because I was doing a presentation about my PhD and she was at it. And she came up to me, and I was doing a presentation about, which was about The Exorcist partly. And she came up to me afterwards, and the first thing she said to me, this is absolutely true, the very first thing she said to me was, I think your thesis is haunted by Freud. And I thought, I am going
she's
to marry
a keeper.
I'm going to marry you, and you are never going to get away from me ever, ever, ever. And I do, if The Exorcist hadn't happened, I wouldn't have been there doing the PhD. I mean, I'm it's that stupid. I've said this to both Bill Blatty and to Billy Friedkin, and they have both laughed at me, as well they should. But the formative experience films, I think.
Yes. Well, look, so maybe on those terms, Castle in the Sky, the first Studio Ghibli film made under the Studio Ghibli banner. So it wasn't Miyazaki's first feature, but it was the first one made as Studio Ghibli. That, I am certain, screened on Channel 4 at some point in the late 80s or the early 90s when I saw it as a kid. And it was like no animation or film I'd ever seen before. And it planted a seed that was never able to be nurtured until the Ghibli films became more widely available. And I think that probably the next Ghibli I saw after that would have been probably Spirited Away, I think. So we're talking about a good decade and a bit later, when it was the surprise film at the Edinburgh Film Festival. And I remember I'd seen it before because I'd imported the DVD because I'd become interested in anime,
but
not specifically
John
Ghibli.
Lasseter was involved in the...
That's right. He was bringing them over to the US, but still that wasn't happening in the UK. But the films were being, I mean, you could like import the DVDs from Hong Kong, and I'd seen a lot of them that way when they just weren't available here at all before Studio Canal had got the license. And I remember it played at the Edinburgh Film Festival as a surprise film that year. I'd already seen it. I was absolutely delighted to be able to experience it big. And then, of course, My Neighbor Totoro, which I became completely obsessed with. Mm-hmm. And I think those are worldview shaping films, the whole Ghibli canon. It changes the way that you look at the earth, and you look at your fellow humans, and you look at the, you know, these enormous cosmic concepts like, you know, time and fate and making the best of your life and all this kind of stuff. And it was also that I became obsessed about going to Tokyo to Studio Ghibli itself in Mitaka and interviewing Hayao Miyazaki and Isao Takahata, who are the two filmmaking parts of the trio. I mean, Toshio Suzuki, who was the third co-founder. Mm-hmm. He's the producer. Those two are the filmmakers. And I became kind of fixated on doing that and eventually managed to interview them both and kind of go to see them at work in the studio. So yes, and I suppose that I'm enormously enthusiastic about Japanese culture as well. And I wonder how much of that can be traced back to just that chance encounter with a Japanese animation, not even realizing it was Japanese on Channel 4, one whenever it was. It must have been a school holiday or something back when I was 8 years old, 9 years old. And seeing those bizarre long-limbed robots in the garden and just having never seen an image like that before. And it just imprinting.
Yeah.
So maybe that's what it is.
I think all of those things are true. The one thing I'd like to say, just kind of slightly tangentially to this, is if you love when movies touch you in a certain way, they do end up affecting the course of your life, and they end up affecting the way that you think. The way that you've just described watching the Ghibli catalog will give you a worldview. It will give you a worldview which is tied into the natural world, and I think that's actually something which is, you know, hugely beneficial. I would also say, on the subject of horror movies saved my life. They were the best thing that happened to me. Again, people speak all the time about the bad effects of horror movies and how, you know, savage and depraved they are. Nobody talks enough about how incredibly liberating and fantastic they are. If you are a miserable, anxious, worried kid who discovers horror movies and you suddenly go, yes, That thing is the thing that will see me through. And I think anyone who can find that in anything, it's a really positive thing, and it is a life-changing thing.
Well, on that unexpectedly profound note, that's it. We've reached the end of take three. And indeed this week's show.
That was
overall.
Fun.
It was fun. It was lovely. Thank you very much for having me.
How was it sitting in the intimidating Simon Mayo chair?
Well, considering I was just kind of chiming in with reviews anyway, it wasn't too bad.
Okay.
It was just, you know, it was the usual beat, but obviously with, you know, taking the cue from yourself, as I've ended up doing for my entire career today anyway. So there we are.